Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky.
My guest is Mona Simpson, whose latest novel is
Casebook, earlier novels, Anywhere But Here, My Hollywood. This is the sixth novel. Mona Simpson also was a writing teacher, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But first, let's talk about your latest novel, Casebook. It's unusual in that the voice of the novel, the person writing the novel in the novel, is a young man. He's a kid who becomes a teenager. He's writing from the perspective of a teenager, which means you have to find the perfect voice. So let me start at the beginning. What drew you to writing the novel, and at what point did the voice come in?
I was trying to write a love story. Actually, the voice didn't come in immediately, but in a way the novel started when I found that voice. I don't think I could have written this novel without that voice. It's hard to write a love story in 2012, 2013, when I was writing this. The love story is always dependent in a way on certain obstacles, which we don't really have, on certain endings, which we no longer consider to be permanent. There are all kinds of tropes for the love story that no longer exactly exist. But those weren't the only difficulties. I mean, a love story is just a very big and head-on thing. I only had access to it, in a way, from this slanted point of view.
So what you're talking about is the story of the narrator Miles' mother, Irene Adler, which sounds, let's say, Conan Doyle-ish, which I guess is deliberate.
Yes, the boys are big Sherlock Holmes readers.
Irene is having an affair after her divorce with a man named Eli. The book is about who he is and their relationship, but it's told from the perspective of Miles.
And Miles, the son, there are three kids actually in the family, but particularly the son and his best friend start out sort of installing walkie-talkies and under the bed and spying on their parents to find out fairly ordinary things that, you know, will they be allowed to watch Survivor during the week? Will they be allowed to buy Game Boys and other devices that they crave? You know, whatever they heard, whether the answer would be yes or no, in some way would be reassuring, because what they would be hearing in that those yeses or those noes would be what they expect. They would expect their parents to be talking about them and thinking about them. The first shock of their discovery in eavesdropping on their parents is that their parents had conversations that had nothing to do with them.
And were boring.
Then they find something and they begin to be suspicious.
This entire notion, you said a love story. You didn't say a mystery. You said a love story. It turns into a kind of
mystery. Well, isn't every love story a mystery?
Yeah, but you know what I mean. You were trying to write it.
I was trying to write both, in a way. I mean, this is, as much as it's a love story, it's also a story about someone watching a love story, which is a very different thing, in a way, than being one of the lovers.
When you first came into it, were you thinking about the relationship of Irene and Eli and where it would go?
I was thinking of that first, but I found that for me, perhaps this says more about me, the author, than one would wish to reveal, but I suppose in some ways I've more often in my life been the person observing a great love story than the person inside one. I think most people, that's probably the case, most of the time. I mean, how many times are you the protagonist of a great love story?
Before we went on the air, I mentioned relationship between your own life and this book. As I was reading the book and thinking about things I knew about you, I was able to jot a few things down. One of the basic elements of your own life is that when your parents divorced, your dad vanished. And I kept thinking, okay.
And my parents were divorced, for those of you who don't know, which is probably most people, very young. So I pretty much grew up without a father.
But there's always a mystery there. There must have been a mystery for you.
Oh, yeah. And also, you know, it's funny. I didn't realize this till after I'd written the book. And lots of people know I have children. I have a son and a daughter. So people have said, is this boy your son? Which it's not. In many ways, it's kind of a mother's fantasy of a son, you know, which is a kid obsessed with his mother. My son wouldn't consider that to be very realistic. But I realized after I wrote this that I actually was in a somewhat similar position to the protagonist of this book. I was a girl watching her mother have romances and having my own anxieties and suspicions and projections onto the suitors, really. I wondered, you know, on the good side, oh, maybe he can help us out financially. because we were somewhat precarious. On the bad side, I'd think, well, what if he breaks my mom's heart? And if I thought he was going to, there was also nothing I could do to prevent it. It was something sort of bigger than I was.
But you didn't get any of this until other people told you after the fact? After
they
read
really. You're kind of in it. You're kind of in it.
You make the decision to make Miles have baby fat because he's going to lose it as he grows up.
Right.
You make the decision to have mom be not any mom, but a great mathematician and professor of mathematics.
Well, actually, she's not such a great mathematician. Her friend is the great mathematician. She's a good mathematician, but she's not really excelling. She's a little bit stalled. She hasn't published anything for 5 years. She tried to take on a big open equation and didn't succeed. She's teaching a little bit more and isn't getting her summer nights. So she feels like she's kind of a beginner and a little bit too old to be.
Why a mathematician?
You know, people love math. I mean, if you're a mathematician, you really love it. And yet it's kind of arcane to the rest of us. I did a fair amount of research for that, and one of the mathematicians I got a lot of information. I got a long, long letter from her. I think we're going to meet for coffee on Saturday. She basically liked the book and thought I got most things right. But she said no one in her generation, she's in her late 30s, I think, or early 40s, who's a female mathematics professor, would ever wear a dress. So that is an inaccuracy, apparently.
Pretty small one, Mona Simpson. Dad, Miles's dad, I could never quite figure out what he did. I think he, at some point, he was a lawyer, but he had a show at the end.
He was an entertainment lawyer.
He was an entertainment lawyer. Okay, but he had a show at the end.
Yes, well, they do that. The entertainment lawyers, they package things.
Well, I kept thinking that one of the reasons you kept it vague is because it sort of is vague for family members what their parents in the entertainment industry do.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think especially for kids who know that their fathers are out working all day, but it's not altogether quantifiable.
And, of course, he has a younger mistress for a while, but don't they all? The other character, his best friend Hector, did you put that much emphasis on what he was like, or did that sort of develop on the side?
They're both the kids of divorces, slightly different divorces. So I was sort of looking at that just as to how the two families fell out.
And Miles and Hector, both of them aren't quite sure about their sexuality.
Right. They have an interesting sexuality. I wanted to explore a little bit. They're best friends, and they're not only best friends, but they're kind of collaborators, not only in this investigation and in this mystery, but when they finally solve the mystery, they then have this sort of energy for collaboration, and they write a comic book about it. And even this book is their latter-day collaboration of coming to terms with what they did and what happened to them. I was very interested in their relationship, which is something I've witnessed a lot, which is they're not exactly sure if they're gay or they're straight, but they at least Hector really hasn't got a sexuality yet that he's aware of. Miles is attracted to one girl in particular, sexually, but on the other hand, he's very much aware of the fact that that girl to whom he's attracted is not even fractionally as important to him as his best friend Hector. So in a way, his emotional relationship is gay, whereas his sexual attraction, at least so far, is heterosexual. And I actually see that a fair amount, even in grown-ups.
Did you let your son vet the book?
Yeah.
And what did he think?
He thinks I got some things wrong, particularly how much the boys were interested in their parents. He thinks there's a whole other world I missed, which I'm sure is true. I mean, I think there's a lot of men and a lot of women whose sort of primary emotional relationship and their primary bond is with somebody of the same sex. And yet they might very well be married and having plausible sex lives with their spouse. But really their juice, their soul exchanges are with somebody of the same gender. It's an interesting thing, I think.
And I think it's very common among adults, and mm-hmm. among married adults even.
Yeah, sure, mm-hmm. because often women who are raising kids, that's their heart work. That's what they really care about, and it's another woman they're talking to about all the details.
Which we learn about through latter-day stories of sisterhood between women
right.
rather than competitiveness.
Well, but it's kind of nice to be living now because one thing that is accepted terrain for not just for fiction writers and readers, but for everybody is that sexuality is much more various and personal and specific to the moment and the situation than we, I think, than we've accounted it to be.
And you set the book between around, I think it's 2002 and the present.
Yeah.
One thing that's missing is music. There is music in the book, but none of the music is contemporary music. And I noticed that neither Miles nor Hector talk at all about whatever music is happening now.
Yeah, that's interesting. They're a little bit retro in their music, and they're a little bit retro in everything.
Well, yeah.
They're nerds, so to speak. There's a lot of ways in which these two kids have kind of dropped out of it. And at the very end, they're trying, their mystery is solved, and they're trying to sort of get back into the life of their generation and their time. And they've kind of dropped out. They've been gripped by an obsession, so they've kind of dropped out of the pop culture altogether of their age group.
Except for comic books.
Right, except for comic books. But even that's a little retro. Comic books aren't really hip for kids of their age. At the beginning, when they were young and reading them. My son says that actually when you get to high school, it's kind of, it still is fringe and nerd, the comic book contingent. It's not the fast, cool kids.
To me, if you bring in too many pop culture references, you're dating the book too much on the one hand. And on the other hand, you're distracting from the real story.
I love the era to kind of poke out. Like, I've been reading Elena Ferrante, and the 60s just kind of pokes out, and it, the politics is sort of there in the background, and if you're reading for it, you definitely get it. But it's not necessarily telegraphed.
One interesting element that is told is the story of their work with the Gay Straight Student Alliance, whatever
right.
it's called, on Proposition 8.
Right.
That extends throughout, and even though Miles thinks he might be straight, and even though he joined it kind of to poke fun at his dad.
We joined it also sort of to see if that he could sell soup through them to make money. But they get into it.
Eli, mother's boyfriend, some things don't quite jibe, which meant for you as the writer, you had to find a way to make it subtle enough so that mom never notices, and perhaps to keep it so subtle that the reader thinks that Miles and Hector may be just fantasists.
Also, I want for a while Miles himself to be unsure of whether it's just that he doesn't love the idea of an interloper or whether there really is something wrong with this particular guy. Because, you know, who does like the idea of someone dating your mom?
Ben Orion, the private eye they run into, who's kind of a movie star-ish looking guy, it seemed to me that you kind of took this really realistic thing and then threw in almost a superhero.
You think Ben Orion's a superhero? It's funny. I did some, he's a contemporary private investigator. And I went and I met a number of L.A. contemporary private investigators, which was really fun and interesting. Their work is different. You know, it's changed a lot with things like no-fault divorce. So they're no longer trying to get pictures of people coming out of hotel rooms to prove adultery. And it's changed a lot also because from what they say, a lot of people do some of their own investigation. It's so easy to tap into other people's privacy vis-a-vis reading their texts, looking at their phone logs, hacking into their email. So many spouses actually find things. So their work has changed a little in its access. One of them did a lot of background research for reality television. Another one did a lot of security for celebrities.
And you use both of those in the book.
Yes, I like both of those.
You're listening to an interview with Mona Simpson, whose latest novel is Casebook. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Casebook itself is a kind of framing device in that this is a book written by Miles and, I guess, vetted by Hector with comments. It never actually disappears into that frame. But why did you choose the frame at all?
Just for a little fun, I think. You know, I don't think this book will satisfy people who really read mystery novels or crime novels. The primary mysteries are emotional and psychological.
Yet you gave it a title, Casebook, which is...
Which could be either. Psychologists talk about casebooks, too.
Where did the title come from?
Well, actually, if you want to know the truth, I had a lot of trouble with this title. I find, for me, titles are either there at the beginning or I get lists of 200. And The Lost Father was a title I had from the beginning. A Regular Guy was a title I had from the beginning. And My Hollywood was a title I had from the beginning. The rest of them, I literally, you know, have yellow notebooks like that with hundreds and hundreds of titles. And then
I guess the title could have been Two Sleuths.
I thought of that, too.
Yeah, why did you decide this one?
I thought of Our Psychopath. I thought of a number of titles. I don't know. I just sort of liked it. I thought Casebook.
You chose deliberately to set it a little bit further in the past.
Right.
Is that because you didn't want to get involved with texting and other technological issues?
No, because there's a fair amount of technological issues. Twitter does not appear, but I wanted to actually I had to move it back a year because I wanted the boy, you know, it's a funny thing. I wanted that voice to be a kid's voice and to have the juice and the fun and the slang of a kid's voice, but still to have some retrospective ability to tell something with a little distance and a little wisdom and a little absorption. So I wanted him to be in his mid-20s. I needed 2014 to be as far out as it went, I thought.
So that's why you
did
it.
Yeah, that's why I did it.
Critics remarked on a relationship with your first novel, Anywhere But Here. What prompted you to kind of go back to some of those earlier themes?
I think one's themes kind of stick to you. I don't, you know, it wasn't a conscious decision, but I think probably your themes stick to you, and if you're not done with them, they'll come up again.
I've talked to a number of authors about writing process, in particular how to create a novel. What is it for you?
It changes as I grow. But I think for me, with this book, I sort of was going, knew the basic points of the plot. But there was a lot I needed to discover about moments and the relationships and the textual minute to minute.
And at that point, it's just pouring out or going slowly or?
I couldn't have really written this book if I hadn't found that voice. So that's a big deal for me. And then when I had that, there was a lot of, for this book in particular, because there were certain suspenses that I wanted to maintain. So there was a lot of sifting through to see what information was given when and what the reader would think at a given point.
How did that voice come to you? You said you were kind of...
I don't know. It was just this little opening. And I thought, that's it. It seemed like just a wedge into a slightly open door.
And when that voice came, how consistent is that voice that you first created with the voice that we see here?
Pretty consistent.
I used to ask, what is the voice? And nobody could really define it other than...
It's really kind of the whole world that you know and believe in language. You could sort of surmise somebody's intelligence, their experience, their wisdom, all that from the voice.
And the voice could be third person, it could be first person.
Yeah, I think so. In this book particularly, I wanted a voice that was naive enough to not be kind of saturated with the palliatives we tell each other. You know, I wanted a voice that was sort of sincere enough to sort of scream when he saw something wrong and just feel like, wah.
He's also very honest. This is not an unreliable narrator at all. I mean,
no.
He's telling the truth at all times.
He's telling the truth as he can parse it.
And when he knows he's wrong, he goes back and fixes it.
Right.
Why does he call his sisters Boop 1 and 2?
That's just the way he sees them. He's not immensely fond of his sisters, although that grows a little bit as the book goes on.
There's some kind of L.A. thing about territory that if you're in Northern California or in any place that the show is being syndicated, you don't quite get. He's in Santa Monica, but there's going to be, and then there isn't a move to Pasadena. From the perspective of Los Angeles, what is the meaning behind that?
Socioeconomically, it's not that different, but it's far. So it would be the equivalent of, say, moving from Berkeley, let's say from the Elmwood District, which maybe they live somewhere like the Elmwood District or Albany, it'd be kind of equivalent to those, to moving to the peninsula. It wouldn't be a huge come down necessarily, although he wouldn't know because Pasadena is large and it could be one of the wealthier areas of Pasadena or more likely one of the middle class areas. But what he's focused on is just it's really far. You wouldn't be able to keep your same school or your friends or any of it. You know, for a kid, that's your life. Your life is your school and your friends.
The character of Eli, the creepy boyfriend, how much emphasis did you put on him? Did you ever really get a read, or were you not so much concerned about who he was except how he was seen through Miles's eyes?
I have a definite sense of him. I can't really go until I need to know a lot about my characters, even that don't, you know, many details that don't even come into the books. I need to sort of really think them out.
Do you have any sympathy for him?
Yeah. He's confused. He's weak. He's unhappy. He's neurotic. He has a compulsion.
He's very dishonest.
Yeah, I don't have sympathy for that.
There's also a strange element of dogs, missing pets, and animal rescue.
Animal transfer, as the boys call it.
Where did that come in? Did that just, like, pop into your head?
Well, that's something I'm interested in. I have a dog. But also, I liked it just the way that ideas and passions kind of move between people. This guy, Eli, who's the boyfriend of the mother's, is interested in that. He's interested in animal rights and in animal care, and he brings that into the family. And they all kind of are interested for a moment, but one of the kids, one of the twin girls, actually takes it up. It becomes her real interest in life. And her brother kind of uses it for his ends. He's trying to get money to fight Prop 8, and he gets it from the animal rights club at school. I just like the way that sort of interest starts somewhere, and someone will take it up and go with it.
Did you have any problems toward the end of the book trying to figure out how to make it satisfying in terms of the confrontations that might occur with Eli? And I'm thinking that...
I hope they were satisfying. I wondered, I mean, the ending, I sort of always knew what would happen at the end, and I wasn't sure if I would still do that, but I did. That felt right.
In your own personal life, you finally did meet up with your dad. How did you find out? I mean, was it a similar situation?
You know, it's a long time ago now, but I really looked for him a long time, and I hired detectives and so forth.
So, on some level, the mystery of family life...
is real to me.
And that sets an entire new world in terms of how you view your own books, because you're always seeing the mystery.
I think that's true, in love and family and all of it. It's full of mysteries and depths.
Mona Simpson, any interest from Hollywood? I know Anywhere But Here was a film.
Yeah, that's true. Somebody has been interested in this for a TV series. I'm not sure how that would work, but they are.
And no interest on your other books, on My Hollywood?
That has some interest, too, but you know how Hollywood is. Who knows? With Anywhere But Here, too, it was a long time between the interest in the film.
Mona Simpson, the mother of Marge, that came about.
Richard Appel worked for The Simpsons. It's funny, I have a history with the television show The Simpsons because, you know, I had my name long before they existed, The Simpsons. And then at one point I was living in New York and people used to say, oh, yeah, I like The Simpsons. And at first I didn't know what they meant, but then I, of course, saw the show. And much later, my young husband, when we were just starting out, got a job there. It was a wild thing. It was a big job, and it was very thrilling. And the first script he wrote for them was about Homer Simpson finding his mother, who'd been missing for many years. So he named her Mona for me. And it had some hilarious results, because we had our son at preschool at the time. And at some point, they asked us, and we were two young writers starting out, and they asked for a phenomenal contribution. I mean, more money than we had, you know, it was preposterous. We said, well, why did you think we could possibly? And they said, oh, well, we thought Mona's name being Simpson and you working for The Simpsons, that you'd created The Simpsons.
Your early writing career, had you wanted always to be a writer?
Yeah, I think so.
Had you been writing all along?
From teenage on.
And before Anywhere But Here, are there old novels sitting in drawers?
There's one that I wrote when I was an undergraduate at Berkeley at Cal. One summer, I was renting a cottage in the flats. The summer of the Hillside Rapist. I wrote a novel, but very much in the Garcia Marquez. We were all influenced by 100 Years of Solitude then, and so it was about thalidomide kids who'd grown up and didn't have full arms and were working at a hotel in the far northern coast of California. Anyway, that one. But other than that, no. I was working on Anywhere But Here for a long time. And in my early years after college, I worked as a journalist here in the Bay Area.
Mona Simpson, you teach writing. I've been here at KPFA for a long time. I kind of want to write something. But when I try to write a memoir, I think I'm going to get sued. And when I try to write something else, it's like, KPFA is unique, and how do I create something like that? And each time I do that, I get stymied, and also in terms of finding a voice. What do I do?
That's a good question. You have material you want to work with. Lots.
Lots.
You just don't sort of know the way in.
That's correct.
My advice would be kind of roundabout, but I think it would work. I would advise you to just give yourself, say, 2 hours a day, every day. Try and make it the same time if you can. And spend the first hour just reading widely among things you love and crave. And make the environment very suitable, very relaxing, if you like tea, if you like coffee, whatever you like. And just write a little bit freely and see what comes to you.
You mean just write anything?
Just kind of write anything. Let your unconscious, try and let your unconscious take you to the opening, and it'll come. I would almost bet you if you did that for 6 weeks, you'd find the thread. And there's kind of a watermark with writing. I mean, if you sort of allow your unconscious and your focus to settle peaceably, I mean, you're not pushing yourself, but being open to the work every day for a certain amount of time, a strange thing happens, and the whole rest of the day, you're kind of seeing the world in that structure, and you kind of pluck things from it. If I work the necessary amount of hours for me, and it varies depending on what part of a book I'm in, but if I work enough that I'm in it all day, then I can be running, I can be at the market, I can be doing anything, and I'll only see the details that will help me in my work. Whereas if I work a half hour less than that, or I don't get in it sufficiently, then all the hours I'm not working, I'm not seeing anything for it. It's kind of like you do that extra little bit, and you get all those extra hours where you're still in it.
Those extra hours, I mean, for you as the mother of kids, did that affect how you functioned as a mother? I mean, if you're...
Probably. I'm sure they have their complaints, but I think they're... I hope I've given them enough. It matters to me a lot to give them enough.
What you're saying is that whether it emerged as a memoir or as fiction...
I wouldn't worry about that now.
At all?
No.
And I would just use the real names. No Irene Adlers.
I would use the real names if you feel like using the real names. Or if you feel, you know, I would just let your... I wouldn't focus on that right now. I wouldn't focus on how accurate it is. If you're just open, it'll probably not be a memoir. It'll probably change. Probably a lot of things will change. Or if it ends up being really true to the facts, then let it be a memoir. I mean, I wouldn't force it into a category before you've even seen what it is that you really want to grapple with.
Some writers have said that you should save your best material for your third or fourth book. Do you think that's true? When you're more acclimated to being a writer.
Well, it's not like once you've spent it, it's gone. I mean, look at someone like Alice Munro who seems to, you know, or Tolstoy. I mean, so many writers seem to go back to the same essential themes and even the essential dramas really can repeat. So I don't think you need to save up your best material. I think you need to write at any given time what you feel most urgently you need to resolve for yourself.
What did you have to resolve for Casebook?
For Casebook, I was really trying to begin to understand what kinds of love seemed authentic to me, what place romance has, what its value was.
When you're done, what do you walk away with? I mean, you as the writer, I mean, the reader, of course, walks away with whatever the reader sees. I mean, I see things here that you didn't even see when you were writing it.
I'm sure that's true. And that's what I love about reading, by the way, as opposed to some other equally compelling, is that there's so much demanded of the reader. The reader puts so much in him or herself. But, I mean, for me, writing books changes me. Every book, I've only written six, I mean, but each one has changed me in a kind of essential way.
Can you put your finger on what changed for this or for My Hollywood?
Yeah, I think so. And My Hollywood's in some ways a bigger book, so there's a lot of things. But I think for this book, I have a clearer sense of, you know, all these books are sort of asking the eternal questions of sort of how to live a good life. In the backdrop of the way we live now, of the mess of the way we live now, which is much less orderly than it used to be. You know, our families are less defined. Parents may not live together. There's lots of mess and chaos. But even with the background of all that, what position should one have towards romantic hope? And where should one find that romantic hope? With this novel, I think what I felt, and I kind of, you know, channeled it a bit through Miles, but I think what he felt by the end was that his mother had been a little too trusting, but he had been a little bit too suspicious. And both were true.
Yes, and yet at the same time, if he hadn't been a little too suspicious, then what?
he would say, I suppose, that all his suspicion, what did it really achieve? He wasn't able to prevent pain.
But he brought about honesty.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Doesn't that count?
Oh, no, that was a good thing and a necessary thing.
Mona Simpson, what are you working on now?
You know, I'm working on two books. We'll see which takes hold. I'm working on one based in Wisconsin, where I'm from, and it's sort of about the people who stayed and the people who left. I grew up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, which is sort of a mill town, a big factory town.
Known for
and
only
big
one
football,
thing, though.
Yes, football town as well. The other one is a kind of a story of three siblings whose mother has, in the middle of their teenage years, who they grew up with a single mom, and the mother, who'd always been a little bit precarious psychologically, really has a breakdown and is institutionalized. And so they make their way out of their teenage years, and it's about how each of them sort of settles into life in their 20s. I'm interested in that point where people find love, find sexuality, find work, fail for the first time.
Have you found the voice for either?
No.
And that's why there are two.
Yes.
You've been listening to an interview with Mona Simpson, whose latest novel is Casebook. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.